always be clear where you get your conservative talk.
The St. Louis Business Journal is now reporting that liberal billionaire George Soros is the largest shareholder of Odyssey,
the parent company of KMOX and 97.1 Talk.
Soros' maneuver raises critical questions about the future of media ownership and influence.
Money and attention is power. And when he has the money and he controls what's on the radio stations, he's going to be able to control the minds, essentially hundreds of millions of Americans.
St. Louis's trusted source and number one.
For conservative talk.
This is News Talk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
Jefferson County prosecutors have dropped all charges against professional golfer Scottie Scheffler, stemming from his arrest earlier this month at the PGA Championship in Louisville, Kentucky. Scheffler was alleged to have dragged and assaulted an officer by failing to stop his vehicle while entering Valhalla Golf Club. Prosecutors saying today that the evidence did not satisfy the elements of any criminal offenses.
Welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Harp Show, 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL. It is Thursday. It's a Thunderdome Thursday. It's Chris Harp's birthday. It's May 30th, 2024. Boy, do we have a jam-packed hour ahead for all of y'all as Donald Trump has been the first president in U.S. history. And you know what? I hope the last. I don't wish this on any president. Democrat,
unless you really committed a crime.
Right. Unless you really, honestly did something horrific that harmed the nation.
Exactly.
Not just that you happen to be the leading political opponent of the opposite political class, right?
Or you got with a porn star. You know, it's all good.
Well, you know.
You do what you
got to
do.
Chris, that's Chris Harps. I'm Tim Jones, producer Joey V here. Before we get to other news, and boy, do we have lots of it, we wanted to mention that now, Chris, do we have even more to talk about? On Tuesday, June the 25th, we are bringing legal expert Zach Smith, who you hear every week on our program, and one of his cohorts and colleagues, Joel Griffith, who is a really funny dude and extremely brilliant as well. We're going to talk about the economy and the courts. Yep, those two things are inextricably linked. And boy, will we have a lot to unpack as the Trump trial verdict will be a couple weeks old at that point, and we'll be awaiting sentencing in mid-July. Yeah. That is at the Funny Bone in St. Charles. Tickets are free, but you have to reserve a seat. Please go to newstalkstl.com. You are not going to want to miss this show. It is going to be jam-packed. It's going to be awesome. We're all going to be there. It'll be fun. It'll be informative. And we might get Vic Porcelli to tell a joke or two.
Exactly.
How about that?
Yeah. And I'm telling you, get your tickets early. You know, human beings have a tendency, especially when something is off in the distance a little bit, to kind of wait to the last minute. Oh, I'll do it later. When we had our last event, we sold out. And we actually had to move things around at the venue, add more chairs
That's
and everything
right.
to accommodate people. So this thing is going to sell out. News Talk STL always has great informative guests, interesting guests. So June 25th at the Funny Bone, Joel Griffith, Zach Smith, get your tickets today before it sells out. Because don't come to me on the 24th saying, hey, Chris, can you hook me up? I'm like, sorry, can't do it.
Chris knows people, but he can't create more seats.
Like, can't do it.
Can't create more seats in the Funny Bone. It's a fixed theater. Joey V, I think, has been at the Funny Bone in St. Charles. I hear it's a pretty cool venue, Joey.
I've been to the one just next door here in Westport tons of times, but I have not been out to the St. Charles one, so I can't wait. And, you know, whenever you go to a Funny Bone, even if it's an open mic, you see stars there. Like, even if they're local stars. Like, I've seen Greg Warren. I've seen Nikki Glaser just doing open mics.
No way.
Wow, so just go, even on a Tuesday when I believe they do their open mics, you'll see some funny people.
And, Joey, you know, you talked a little bit about it. We talked before the show. You've done a little stand-up in your day there.
I think
I asked Joey, because Joey has a very dry sense of humor.
Yes.
Sometimes you don't know when he's serious or joking. And I asked him, have you done a little stand-up? And you said?
I have done an open mic, and if you do it at a bar, like a rowdy bar, it's really loud and no one pays attention to you. But if you do it on radio, like what I do with Todd Showalter on the Right Mind Show Saturday at 5, we're funny and everyone has to listen to us. There's no audience in the room. Mm. And we just assume everyone's listening with their mom and eating their bowl of oatmeal and just looking at the radio.
This is the second time I brought this up. You will not tell me how you did in your stand-up. You just say you did it. It was fun. How did you do?
It was in a loud bar, so I assume people just weren't paying attention.
Were things thrown at you, Joey?
No, that's what I'm asking. Nothing was thrown at me.
Were there howls, jeers?
Oh,
get off the stage, bum, any of that.
Quit blocking the TV, the Cardinals are on. I think that's the best reaction you can get in an environment like that.
Now, Joey, do your family and friends laugh at your jokes like mine do, or does your girl roll her eyes like my wife does when I try to be Mr. Funny Man?
They love my jokes.
You know, I thought so.
I
knew it.
Edgy, Mr. Edgy on Twitter. just writing the raciest stuff, thinking I would be funny offending people, and then Conan O'Brien would come whisk me away. And then I went and applied for a job, and they said, what's up with your Twitter here? And I did not get that job, and then I turned, it all private. So now I just tell jokes to my girl and just about movies.
So your jokes kept you from going to Hollywood?
Maybe.
Maybe.
I was trying to get a job at what is called Radio for the Blind.
Okay.
And they're very religious over there. And when they saw my Twitter feed, they're like, I don't think you're going to fit in over here.
Well, Joey's persona is just, Joey exists as a very funny guy, because yesterday, he doesn't say anything. He just walks in and he's got this t-shirt on that just says, I'm offended on it. And I just got to, I'm staring at that the whole show and I'm getting a kick out of it, and I'm trying not to laugh through some serious interviews. But
that's Todd Showalter original. You get it from a store.
Yes.
Oh, okay.
Yes, StudioTodd.com. Studio Todd. That. I saw Todd today, so I complimented him on your awesome chalk drawings.
Of course. You know, every week when we do our episode, we put out some crazy photo, and today happened to coincide with Picture Day at the station.
Yes.
The beautiful voice of the gods, Jim Maggi, was doing our headshots today, and we were all dressed up, and I said, let's sneak Todd in there. He looks real pretty today.
Well, folks, yep, Donald Trump has been found guilty. Look, Katie Fitzpatrick was just asking me, Tim, how in the world did they find him guilty on all 34 counts? Very easily. The 34 counts refer to the 34 different instances by which the hush money payments were made. So it's kind of like a connect. It's kind of like connect the dot, you know. If they were going to find, I will say this, if they were going to find him guilty on one charge, they would probably have to find him guilty on all 34. Mm-hmm. Either not guilty on all 34, guilty on all 34, or hung jury. Those were honestly the three possible alternative, and I honestly thought there would be two alternatives. I thought it would be guilty on all 34, or I thought there would be a holdout or two. Chris, we talked about the potential holdouts. They held out for a couple days, but then they had that read back. They got the jury instructions again, which I think are part of reversible error and going to be part of the appeal. And then they found all 34. So don't think of it as 34 separate crimes. It was 34 separate instances of the same alleged criminal activity.
Exactly. That's what my understanding is. The 34 counts are each payment to Stormy Daniels, basically.
Yes.
Each entry ledger into the book saying we've paid Stormy Daniels, that's a count.
Correct, Chris. You're right. So they took the same instance. The instance was Donald Trump, Stormy Daniels, hush money payments, non-disclosure agreement, some vague, still unknown after the trial is over and the verdict is in, a federal elections law violation. That's the instance. That's the matter.
Mm-hmm.
Within that umbrella, they have a Bragg, of course, wanted to hit Donald Trump with as much crap as he could. So he broke it out into 34 separate counts, 34 separate instances. So that's all it really means. So you're either, in my mind, on this case, you're either guilty of all 34 or you're not. Or you have a hung jury where somebody goes, you know, this doesn't pass the smell test. And I think despite the jury, despite New York City, despite the leanings of the judge and the obvious bias, I think both Chris and I and many of you were probably thinking, okay. There's one rational, sane person on that jury who's going to be like, we cannot do this to the American system of politics, public policy, and jurisprudence. Well, they did. New York continues to be a place where more people are going to leave. I'm sorry.
Especially when it was determined, or we learned, that there were two attorneys on the jury. I thought for sure that they would see through the judge's instructions. They would see that this case is kind of bogus, even if they are maybe center left, and in good conscience couldn't convict Donald Trump of this made up charge. That was kind of I was banking on.
Yeah. And we don't know much about these lawyers other than there was two of them and they're lawyers. Okay. These two lawyers could have been estate planning attorneys, all right, or real estate attorneys, or maybe they dealt with bankruptcy law.
Now you want to put a disclaimer there. You're not dogging out real estate attorneys.
No, I'm not. What I'm saying, Chris, is they may never have touched a jury instruction in their life.
Right.
You know what I mean? I don't want anybody to think that all attorneys are created equal, and I don't mean that disparagingly. I mean that a constitutional lawyer is not going to know much about the Uniform Commercial Code. A bankruptcy attorney is not going to know much about personal injury law or defamation. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. Lawyers, there are generalists out there, but even amongst generalists, they generally will be in a specific area. You'll be like a trial attorney that handles certain kinds of cases or others, and you don't touch other. The law is voluminous, right? The law goes back centuries. Even in this country, it goes back centuries. And so, yes, there are some generalists out there, but most of the, in more situations than not, attorneys specialize in particular areas. So just because there was a couple lawyers on the jury, we can't presume until we find out otherwise that either of these lawyers has ever been in a courtroom or ever handled a litigation. And more specifically, I doubt either of them are criminal defense attorneys or former prosecutors. But we'll find out, and maybe I'll be surprised.
But even if they are practicing law that's not constitutional law, as attorneys, wouldn't they still be kind of suspect
of
some of the judges with the judge instructions? It's like, this is not the law that I practice.
I would want them to be.
It's like, wow, this seems awfully complicated, or doesn't seem that this goes with what we're talking about, or this doesn't necessarily seem, you know, fair.
Excellent point. Chris, they should all lawyers should be analytical. They should all be logical. They should all know how to take an issue, apply the rule of law to it, analyze that conjunction, and then come up with a conclusion.
Yeah.
Every lawyer is taught that. You know why I was able to just say that? Because it was drummed into our heads for 3 years. It's called the IRAC system.
Right.
Issue, rule, analysis, conclusion. You're taught to do that with everything. And so, yeah, Chris, I would have hoped they would have done that. I've been yelling and screaming from high heaven about my problems with these jury instructions, and many of you who have never even thought about the words jury instruction in your life, you may not know what's Jones yelling and screaming and bloviating about. I found a piece that I think encapsulates what I've been saying. I'm going to get to that in today's speaker stump speech in a second. And then Chris at 5:25, we're going to talk to another great Chris. We're going to talk to Chris DeGaulle, member of the Herzog Foundation, host of Making the Leap. You know, a lot of this situation that we find ourselves in this country is because of our educational system. Mm-hmm. We're going to continue to talk to Chris DeGaulle about how we can hopefully remedy that in the generations ahead. Without further ado, let's unpack these jury instructions and the problems there, too, in the Trump trial case, the subject of today's Speaker Stump Speech.
Listen to me, listen to me.
I'm very consistent. I'm a very stable genius.
It's time for the Speaker Stump Speech, sponsored by Hanson's Tree Service at hansonstree.com.
From thefederalist.com, and if you know how I do my Speaker Stump Speech, I generally try to find a foundational document, something to analyze, something to read, and then I provide you my editorializing along the way, which I will do. John Daniel Davidson, one of my favorite writers at The Federalist. You can read this along at home as well. Judge Merchant's jury instructions prove Trump's trial is not about power. I'm sorry. Let me start over. Judge Merchant's jury instructions prove Trump's trial is about power, not the law. The raw exercise of power Judge Merchant has displayed against Trump throughout this trial is meant to demoralize and threaten his supporters. Folks, what does that tell you? That tells you this case was not about the law. It was not about the issues. It was not about an analysis of that law to the issues. And it was not about a proper conclusion of justice. It was about politics, and it was about putting your finger on the scale of such. John Daniel Davidson writes, if you've been following former President Donald Trump's hush money trial in New York, you might have seen the shocking news that the judge in that trial, Judge Merchan, issued bizarre and plainly unconstitutional jury instructions on Wednesday. Folks, if that's true, that's reversible error right there. That's what I've been talking about. Telling jurors, here's the money line. They need not agree on what crime Trump allegedly committed to reach a unanimous guilty verdict. See, I wasn't crazy. I wasn't making things up. John Daniel Davidson is thinking the same thing I'm thinking. What I learned in law school and what I learned in the prosecutor's office and what I learned as part of the bar here in the state of Missouri and New York was that the opposite is true. John continues, you read that right. According to the judge, the jury could come back with a guilty verdict without agreeing on whether Trump committed election fraud, tax fraud, or falsification of business records. He essentially divided the jury into three groups of four, saying that if they're split 4-4-4 on what crime Trump committed, he'd treat that as unanimous. To say this is unusual is, of course, a gross understatement. As Guy Benson noted on Twitter X, it amounts to a choose-your-own-adventure jury instruction. To make sense of these instructions, however, one must first understand the insane underlying theory of the case the prosecution has attempted to make. No easy task. It goes something like this. Manhattan DA Bragg indicted Trump on 34 counts relating to allegations Trump instructed his former lawyer, Michael Cohen, the adjudicated liar, to pay hush money to pornographer Stormy Daniels to conceal a past affair, and then falsify business records to label the payments as legal fees instead of campaign expenses. Setting aside that it would have been a violation of federal campaign finance law to label such payments as campaign expenses, so they didn't, Trump's alleged falsification of business records would only qualify as felonies. This is another point that we've been making for about the last year. If they were done in the service of some other crime Trump intended to commit or conceal. What crime was that? I've asked that. Trey Gowdy has asked that. Andrew McCarthy has asked that. Jonathan Turley has asked that. Attorney General Andrew Bailey, who we just interviewed, has asked that. Everybody's asked that. They've even asked that on CNN. The prosecutors have been vague on that point. No one can really say what crime, if any, the alleged falsification of business records was connected with. Even now, after closing arguments, it's not clear what underlying crime Trump was trying to conceal. During closing arguments earlier in the week, Merchant allowed the prosecution to claim repeatedly Trump committed federal campaign violations. Folks, that's not true. He didn't. There's no adjudication of that. There's been no determination of that. He then said the prosecution had referenced three possible crimes that could constitute the illegal means Trump used to influence the election. A federal elections violation, which didn't happen, an alleged tax violation, and an alleged falsification of records. Jurors need not agree on which of these three occurred, but could also reach a unanimous verdict so long as the crime they all agree on was in furtherance of another crime. So you make up one thing, you invent another thing, and then you come up with a conclusion of guilty. That means this case was all about not justice, but whether or not Orange Man bad. It gets worse. Merchant also barred Trump's defense lawyers from explaining to the jury no campaign finance violations had occurred, and then allowed prosecutors who gave their statement after the defense. I find that weird as well. I don't know if that's a change in New York law they made after I left or what, but that's weird. To claim falsely that federal campaign finance violations had indeed occurred. The judge didn't try to correct prosecutors or clarify any of this for jurors. I think that's another case of reversible error. John goes on and says, it's pretty clear by now, if it wasn't before, the entire trial was a fishing expedition designed to convict Trump of something, anything, just make it up. Professor Jonathan Turley called it manufactured criminal theory, which it obviously is. Last April, when the indictment was unsealed a year ago, John's colleague Margot Cleveland wrote that Bragg had attempted to, quote, bootstrap a federal elections violation onto state law by claiming Trump falsified the business records to conceal campaign finance crimes, and the charges were even more pathetic than anticipated. The only way to understand any of this is to realize it's not about the law, and never was, or seeing justice done for a crime, which it isn't even up to this point. It's about power. Denying Trump basic constitutional rights such as due process, as Merchant has done in this case, is a way to demonstrate Trump has no power compared to New York Democrats who are trying to jail him at any cost before the November election. That was also the purpose of the unintentionally humorous press conference with actor Robert De Niro, the Biden campaign, held outside the courthouse this week. These demonstrations of power aren't meant merely to demoralize Trump and restrict his ability to campaign for president. They're meant to demoralize all of you that, whether you support Trump or not, you support Republicans over Democrats who are destroying the country. You support sane Americans versus insane ones. Trump voters are meant to understand their man's going down. It would be smart for them to simply submit. What did they say in Star Trek? Resistance is futile. It's also something more than that. It's a threat. After all, if they can do this to Trump, just imagine what they can do to you. And that's the Speaker Stump Speech for today. Chris, the whole thing is an abomination.
It is an abomination. And as we said many, many times, this is a political witch hunt. This is a political trial. This is political interference at the highest levels, where the president of the United States is using the Justice Department and his allies in the New York judicial system to attack Donald Trump and help them to be able to call him a convicted felon in the campaign season. Mm-hmm.
Folks, how can we fix all this? Well, we won't fix it overnight. We won't even fix it in the next year or so. We won't even fix it with this no election. We'll fix it with a generational effort to educate the masses, and it starts with the kids. Chris and I are going to talk to Chris DeGaulle next about that and so much more. Stand by. The Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show rolls on here at 101.9 94.1 Newstalk STL.
For podcast articles and more, find us on NewstalkSTL.com.
Take a look here. Age 18 to 24. Biden won this group by 32 points last cycle over Donald Trump. Look at where the polling is now. Joe Biden still leads, but just by 7 points. That is a drop, John. Let's see if I can do this math. I believe it is a drop of 25 percentage points.
Welcome back to the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show, 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL. Chris, there's going to be political ramifications to this. What do you think? I mean, it's a little early, but given everything we've seen over the last year and a half of what this lawfare has done to the polls, this could end up helping Donald Trump, because it seems like everything the left has tried to do has been boomerang on it. I mean, no, you don't want to be called convicted felon Donald Trump, but it seems like they've called him everything under the sun, and it's only made him more popular with his base. And, Chris, I saw even amongst independents. Mm-hmm.
I think this definitely is going to help Donald Trump. I think one of our listeners on the stream said that his website has crashed. So I'm sure he is receiving all kind of donations. And we know that there is an enthusiasm gap with the Democrats in this election cycle. There is not one with the Republicans. I think this verdict, I think this verdict here is going to just widen that enthusiasm gap between the Republicans and the Democrats. And that's not good for them. We just heard that poll showing there that he's losing support among African Americans.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Chris, I heard, what did I hear today? That by some...
Or young people.
You're right on both counts. And in some polls, African American support for Donald Trump is up to nearly 25%. And even Dan Bongino today on our station, which you should listen to his show every afternoon because he does such a great job for 3 hours. He said, even Dan's like, I don't know that I believe 25%, but if it's anywhere close to that, the Biden White House is in trouble.
I think it is at 25%. And, you know, usually you hear high numbers like that for President Trump with African-American men. This is African-Americans as a whole, 25%. And I think the Democrats have to worry about that high percentage, because we know with a percentage like that, it would be very difficult for them to win. I think they also have to worry about African-Americans being excited to come out and vote for him, because African-Americans staying at home is the equivalent of voting for Donald Trump this fall.
Yeah, one of the concerns you often hear from the minority community, whoever they might be, wherever they are in the country, is the criticism that they levy against the weaponization of the legal system, yeah. Right? And I think people are going to look at this and go, yeah, this is ridiculous and we don't like it. I saw a poll today, independents as a whole across the nation, no matter who they are, if they're an independent voter, 8-point surge for Donald Trump over Joe Biden.
Yeah, and President Trump did a brilliant move last week during his Bronx rally. As you said, a lot of African Americans, and he has said this, feel that they can identify with him because of his troubles with the law. Two of the people that were on stage at the rally were rappers, Tim, that are facing criminal charges. I think that helped burnish his street cred there with the audience there, to be associated with people that have been accused of serious crimes, not afraid to do that. And I think it helped him identify with that audience even more.
And look, we want a lawful society. We want to be a nation of laws. But when the people who are supposed to be fairly adjudicating the laws, when they abuse their power and they become lawless, that's even more dangerous, because these are supposed to be authority figures, right? Mm-hmm. They have the power. A prosecutor, I can tell you, has a wide amount of discretion. that doesn't mean you should use that power absolutely. You should try to be fair and judicious. And when people see an abuse of that, they correctly, rhetorically retaliate, because that's a dangerous place to be in, because mm-hmm. prosecutors wield an enormous amount of power, and if they're not using it properly, all Americans should be concerned.
Yeah, and the foundations of a democratic society start to crumble when, one, people don't believe that the laws are fair, and two, when people don't believe that the elections are fair. The United States is facing crisis right now in both of those areas, and it's frightening, Tim. People don't believe that our elections are fair, and that's frightening.
Mm-hmm. Josh Hawley is our senior senator now, right? We got two young guys. So senior senator Josh Hawley just released the following statements condemning the conviction of President Trump on all 34 counts brought to him by the far left wing Soros funded prosecutor Alvin Bragg. Those are all factual statements. Josh Hawley says, "This is America under Democrat rule, prosecuting political opponents, whether it's pro-life Americans or a former president. The trial from beginning to end has been a complete and total sham, a mockery of our criminal justice system, one of the most dangerous abuses of our political process in American history." A lot of common themes we're hearing from pretty much everybody who's been critical of this verdict.
Yeah, I mean, people understand the tawdry nature of hush money payments, porn star, all of that. But I think most thinking people don't understand how that equates to a trial where you have been convicted of 34 felony charges, charges that were originally the statute of limitations ran out of them. And Bragg twisted the justice system into a Gus's pretzel and trying to convict Donald Trump. And this is a Pyrrhic victory. They are winning at this stage. But I think, as the Missouri Attorney General, and you have said, Tim, that this case should be, probably will be, overturned on appeal.
Mm-hmm. We'll see what the results of that might be.
Chris DeGaulle is the most sweetest, modest guy. He thought Trump in the big news is way more important than him.
Oh, no, Chris.
No, we always have time for him. Because
so we can bring him in if you're ready.
And we're masters of segues. And the way we're going to segue into this conversation is, we were talking earlier about the fact that, you know, how did we get here in this nation mm-hmm. where we're weaponizing the judicial system against political opponents? And a lot of it has to start and end with where these last few generations of Americans have been educated.
Exactly.
So we're going to talk to Chris DeGaulle about that and so much more. Chris, good afternoon. Welcome back to the program.
Fellas, what a dark day. And I actually, that was my fault that you weren't able to connect with me earlier. I assumed, because of the breaking news today, I would take a back seat. So I'm grateful for the opportunity, and I agree with you completely. It's just, what a devastatingly dark day. I really do hope even the most partisan people in your audience understand the gravity of it. It's, there's no returning from this thing. You know?
And Chris, a lot of this is, you know, you know, it's like we're sitting here going, how in the world do we get to this point? And I think part of it, we have to lay the blame at the foot of one of our other institutions that's been so damaged and harmed over the last several decades, and that's our educational system. And you look at some of these stories, and you're like, okay, well, now I understand why we're an upside-down world. How about the fact, Chris, that here in the state of Missouri, in Webster Groves, which is about, you know, 5 minutes down the road from our overly ostentatious studios here in Maryland Heights, a high school faces scrutiny over a gender ideology survey. I mean, what are we doing in our public schools?
Yeah, it's insane. We're clearly not prioritizing civics. You're right. I mean, these are future jurors who will go on in the fate of something as significant as a current president or a former president who would ostensibly become the next president of the United States. We've never done anything like this. So yeah, you have schools now prioritizing things like choose your gender, a gender assigned at birth, as a mandatory curriculum, and forcing people to take class surveys that make you basically assign your gender, as opposed to understand as a biological fact that you're born with. I'm sort of out of creative ways to tell you we're screwed, guys.
Yes.
Chris DeGaulle, to show you just how much we love you and love talking to you every other week, can you hold on while we go to a break and bring you back and end the show with you?
I'd be honored, guys. Thank you so much.
All right, let's do it. We're speaking with Chris DeGaulle. He is with the Herzog Foundation. He's the host of the great podcast, Making the Leap. Folks, we're going to take a quick break. In the meantime, if you want to, if you're near a computer or your phone, not while you're driving, and want to jump on readlion.com, we're going to be discussing some of those stories and very important stories about the future of our nation, because that's what our children are. And we better start educating them properly, or we're going to continue to see the disastrous result of what we saw today in a New York City courtroom. It is all tied together. Fair enough. 5:41 in the Heartland. When we come back, we're going to continue our conversation with Chris DeGaulle of the Herzog Foundation. Then we'll hand you off to Larry Connors, USA. All that and more straight ahead. 101.9 94.1 News Talk STL.
For podcasts, articles, and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.
A year after a submarine exploded while carrying passengers down to the site of the Titanic wreckage, killing all five people on board, a billionaire from Ohio is now planning to plunge back in. Real estate investor Larry Connor is planning to take a two-person submersible more than 2.3 miles deep in the sea to the site of the Titanic. Now, he told the Wall Street Journal, quote, "I want to show people worldwide that while the ocean is extremely powerful, it can be wonderful and enjoyable and really kind of life-changing if you go about it the right way."
5:46 on the Tim Jones and Chris Arp Show. And until they said that investor was from Ohio, I thought it was our own Larry Connors. I didn't know if Larry was rolling like that, was a billionaire, but there's an S on that name, Larry Connor and Larry Connors. Bringing back with us is Chris DeGaulle, member of the Herzog Foundation. Chris, I want to ask you, we're all capitalists here. We love people making money and enjoying themselves. This gentleman wanted to take a submersible after what happened last year. Is this a symptom of just having too much money and you don't know what to do with it?
Yes, and if he's just got a death wish, I've got all kinds of creative ways to help if he wants to give me some of it. I'll take half a million, and I can come up with creative ways to die if that's what he wants to do.
Fair enough indeed. Oh, Chris, we're
horrifying. I mean, may I ask you a sincere question, just while we're on the topic? I know that's not why you had me, but I really do wonder, is that something you'd ever do in a million years, is go down in one of those things?
No. I think that I would have claustrophobia. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've ever been up in the Arch, Chris, but you're in this little egg-like thing that seems like it's about equivalent to this submersible. So I have problems being in that for a half hour going up to the top of the Arch. Now that this thing has exploded, hell no, I'm never going to do that.
It is so funny you bring up the Arch. I went up in it as a kid in middle school taking a tour, and it was the most I'll never forget it. It was horrifying. And the only other time that I can remember being as scared was as a small kid getting stuck under my grandparents' bed playing hide and seek. I got snagged. My shirt got snagged. I couldn't get out from under it. I have lived in horror. That sounds like the pit of hell terror.
Exactly.
Like a nightmare, guys. Oh, my gosh.
It does indeed. Chris, you know, some people in the country seem to be getting the message and the clue that parents obviously want choice when it comes to educating their kids, and they shouldn't be trapped and shackled to a zip code where there is nothing but failing school districts. The money should follow the child. The parent should be able to make the choice. One of those battles we saw play out all year long in the state of Texas, where they had some runoff elections this week, and a little bit of a mixed bag on the congressional level. And the Speaker of the House did survive barely. However, Chris, when you go down ballot, it appears that the majority of the Republicans who were opposing school choice were outed last night, or the night before, Tuesday night, in the state of Texas. I believe it was 11-4 when it came to pro-school choice versus anti. This movement, which started during COVID, it's definitely picking up steam and not going anywhere other than continuing to excite and engage people, isn't it?
Holy cow, Tim, you're so right. And the playbook, it's funny, I interviewed Corey DeAngelis, who you may know,
school
choice reformer. And Corey's got a new book out, and fascinating guy. And he's been kind of, in the room with a lot of these legislators and governors to kind of help walk them through the school choice battle. And one of the role models, I asked him in this interview today, I said, who's doing it really well? Like, if you were to point to a leader out there, who's doing it well? And they said, well, there's a few. But the first person he mentioned was Kim Reynolds, the governor of Iowa, to our north. And he cited her very specific, and I talked with a guy called Bob Vanderplatz, who is the head of an organization called the Family Leader in Iowa, sort of an activist group for the family and Christian-based organization. And he similarly, in an interview, confirmed that Kim Reynolds was the one in the Republican ranks who strategically decided it's not enough to advocate for school choice. And it's not enough to just fight with Democrats. We have a majority here, and I need to figure out who are the soft Republicans on this issue. And Kim Reynolds and guys like Bob Vanderplatz in Iowa strategically targeted soft, squishy, or recalcitrant Republicans on school choice, and it was a clean sweep. She, with her advocacy, took out all Republicans in an election cycle who were soft on the issue and helped primary in new Republicans who were supportive. And that's when, with a supermajority, she ran the tables and they got universal school choice in Iowa. Greg Abbott down in Texas watched that and called her. And Kim Reynolds has been putting on a clinic, literally putting on a clinic on how to do this. And Greg Abbott watched and primaried these folks, as you just read the numbers. And yeah, they had a big sweep. So watch for Texas to be the next state.
Bob Vanderplatz
achieve this.
Bob Vanderplatz is a great Christian leader up there in Iowa. He was a supporter of Ted Cruz in Iowa, and I was on the Cruz campaign, so I got a chance to meet him at several campaign stops. He's really a great guy. Chris, on Read Lion today, there's a story about a biological male that has taken third in the girl shot putting competition. Now, we've talked many times about transgender athletics and how the males seem to dominate. Doesn't this make the case for the transgender case that it's okay for them to compete with females because this biological male came in third in a shot put contest? And first of all, I want to see this biological male. How did you not win the thing? First of all, that's my big question.
Yeah, no, to be perfectly clear, are there really, really weak men and boys out there? Oh, sure they are. Sure they are. And maybe he's one. I don't know. And not every man can beat a woman just head to head simply because he's a man or a boy. That's true and that's clear. But it's a statistical matter when you talk about sports and competitive athletics. For heaven's sakes, yes, men are just structurally different and in the muscular skeletal makeup of men and boys is traditionally, it favors them in terms of strength and production. Not always true, not universally true, but mostly true. And I think, you know, you're hearing now that this Title IX bus tour, the Independent Women's Forum group, is Riley Gaines and so many other athletes from the collegiate level are gathered together and they're traveling the country. Martina Navratilova, guys, even now she is a rabid left of center political figure on everything else, but on this, she's aligning with people like the aforementioned Ted Cruz. This issue is bringing out some of the strangest political bedfellows. I talked with the former women's lacrosse coach at Oberlin, who lost her job for speaking out on this issue. And I asked her, I said, you're talking to these women around the country, and we're told that women care about one issue and one issue only. You know the issue, guys, abortion. Mm-hmm. Well, that's all that women ever wrote on these days. Mm-hmm. And I said, do you think this fall that this issue of Biden's rewrite of Title IX could actually trump the issue of abortion? And she said unequivocally, yes. She believes, whether they'll say so out loud or not, many, if not most women, are deeply concerned about this, and it will change the tide and even stave off that abortion wave that we've been seeing, because this is such a big deal to women. I don't know if that's true, but that was one woman's prediction.
Well, yeah, Chris, I want to follow up on that, and I think you're right. I think, you know, whether it's the weaponization of the judicial system against Donald Trump or it's some of these insane things that we discuss with you every week, I think, Chris, that arch leftists are shooting themselves in the foot by focusing so much on this Trump lawfare, because they're not going to be able then to pivot and say, oh, yeah, yeah, but what about abortion rights and saving democracy? Because these are the things that are going to be on people's minds, right, Chris? Whether they want to live in a sane versus an insane world. And you mentioned Martina Navratilova. I always think of J.K. Rowling, who is a well-renowned arch-liberal feminist, but she's a feminist as in female, and she stands up for biological women's rights. And I think that's maybe what this election could turn on, right, is whether we're going to live in a sane world versus an insane world. And it seems that a lot of the insanity is being propagandized onto our kids in public schools.
You know, fellas, I'll drive it home with this interesting story. In Philadelphia this week, Joe Biden, I think it was Wednesday or Tuesday, don't remember, it doesn't matter. He came to a place called Girard College. Now, this is a private boarding school in Philadelphia that is primarily made up of urban core Philadelphians, most of whom are residents of Philadelphia. It's a majority black city, Philadelphia. Kids, if they're a single parent home and they meet the criteria for not having the funds to cover it themselves, these kids are given a basically shelter and food and a place to, and this is their mission statement, safely learn in a safe learning environment 5 days a week. Joe Biden visited this place this week to speak to black families about promises made, promises kept, and he was ostensibly there to court the black vote. The irony of him going to a private institution that gives kids and a family the freedom of choice to exit the hellscape of Philadelphia public schools and enter in what they even call a safe place for kids to learn, this boarding school. I couldn't believe it. I couldn't believe that there would be a black family watching Joe Biden in this private school, looking at him saying promises made, promises kept to the black community, when in fact the polling is through the roof. In black communities, they want out of these failing public schools. They want a choice. They want taxpayer funds back in their pocket to send their children to schools that are safe and effective. And it is amazing to me that there is a single woman, frankly, a single person of color, a single American that doesn't see, not only the madness, but this failing school system, this indoctrination factory that's failing our kids. We've all got to want better for ourselves. And name one thing that's better in this current administration. Name one.
Chris, thank you so much. We love talking to you. We'll speak with you in another week and a half. And you are Chris DeGaul, member of the Herzog Foundation, and host of the podcast Making the Leap. Thank you so much, Chris.
Thanks, gentlemen. Always a pleasure.
We are about to end the show, but Prosecutor Bragg has made a statement. We can play a little bit of that, and we'll end the show out.
In the first degree, to conceal a scheme to corrupt the 2016 election. And while this defendant may be unlike any other in American history, we arrived at this trial and ultimately today at this verdict in the same manner as every other case that comes through the courtroom doors, by following the facts and the law and doing so without fear or favor. I want to conclude by expressing deep gratitude to the NYPD and the officers of the Office of Court Administration for securing the courthouse, all of our safety, making sure the courthouse and all of the other matters that are important in their own right continued seamlessly. They will continue to be and have always been incredible partners.
For podcast articles and more, find us on newstalkstl.com.